We have some guests in studio today, all the way down from the Six Nations standoff from up in Caledonia there. This is Nanda and two of her friends who have decided to come down into our studios at my request after having read her article in the May Day magazine for the month of May, ironically enough. I wonder what it was like from the First Nations point of view, standing behind the police barricade, the OPP police barricade, by the way, on Argyle Street, otherwise known as Highway Number 6, the night that Caledonia citizens decided to do a peace rally in front of the OPP line.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
You want to just tell our listeners what it was like that first night?
It was pretty scary. I mean, for anyone who read my article, it was pretty obvious that that was something that I've never really experienced before. Being faced with a mob of people screaming out racist remarks was a lot more than I'm used to.
You live in that area, right?
Yeah, yep. I grew up on Six Nations. I've lived there pretty much my entire life. I'm a student at Laurier Brantford.
Have you experienced that kind of hatred before?
I come from a multiracial family. My mother is of Irish descent. My mom's Canadian. And my father's Haudenosaunee. So growing up on the reserve, there was a lot of tension. I think also going off of the reserve and being in towns like Caledonia and Brantford, there was also tension because people recognized me as a Haudenosaunee child. So there was kind of like this double-edged sword going on growing up that, you know, I wasn't really accepted by a lot of the Indigenous peers that I had because of my mother's heritage, and I wasn't really accepted by a lot of my Canadian peers because of my Indigenous heritage. So it's not something that was foreign to me to feel racism. But at that level, with an angry mob, and especially when the people that are behind the barricades are standing up for justice, that I didn't expect to fuel racism. I really can't even articulate it very well. You know, we were all, I think, on the night of the first peace rally, they called it, pretty shocked at the way that the people of Caledonia were behaving. I couldn't even tell you if it was only people from Caledonia or if it was people in support of the people of Caledonia, but somehow their frustrations translated into an issue of race. Whereas for us, I think the issue was more of accountability and having to deal with a government that we consistently have been lied to by. That's I think been our issue. So to see the response from the Canadian public be racial was very shocking for a lot of us. It was silent behind the lines when they were screaming. They were waving Canadian flags and singing the national anthem and to taunt us. It wasn't a matter of pride or national identity. It was to taunt.
They weren't there to find out why you had a blockade, why you were doing a standoff. They didn't want to know.
Absolutely not. They weren't there to rally peacefully and to come to any kind of a place where we could have a sense of mutual understanding. It was all about sort of responding to what I guess the media has played it up to be, and that is a racial definition. They're not seeing this as a stand of social justice. They're seeing this as a stand of Indians, and they're defining it as Indians doing this. And even that term in itself, we're not Indians. That's something that was created by the state. That is the other, quote, that was created by the state. That's not who we identify as. I'm an Indigenous person by culture, by what I do every day, not an Indian.
There's so many things to clear up. There's a lot of confusion. Let's start off with why you were there in the first place.
People are in Caledonia, they're complaining, our town's hurt, our economy is being hurt. You know, these native people have destroyed our town by blocking the road, and, you know, all the money, there's not as much money coming into town. But what they don't realize is that the economy, 40% of their economy is coming from us, because people come from the reserve to buy food there, to buy clothes there, you know. And they're saying that we hurt them. This is 2 months. Try 500 years, Caledonia. You know, that's where it hurts, and that's what we've been through. We've been ignored for 200 years since that Haldimand Treaty, and we've been quiet. We've been respectful. You know, we've been treated like garbage. We've been through it, man. A to Z, you name it, we've been through it. And now, because we stand up for our rights, you know, and we're 2 months into it, and even some of the media's portray us as bad people, and they think they have it bad. Try living in my shoes.
Tell us what it's like to live in your shoes.
Well, I started going there a week after it first started. I had moved in there. I was driving by with my sister, and we were talking about it. I said, let's drive by there. I want to go by, right? Because I've been in support of it the whole time. We went there, and I seen the people there, went and talked, and, you know, I might have known a person or two. And the next day, I was there, and I had pretty much been there every day since then. Like, I was camping in a tent when it was minus 15 degrees out, you know, because I believe in this. And these people are saying that they're going through insecurities and they're uncomfortable. You know, I was sleeping in a tent in the winter for rights, because the government thinks that they can make us forget all this stuff, and that, you know, I'm just wasting my time being out there. But no, that's how I'm protesting. You know, that's why I'm out there.
Let's talk about what your life has been like before.
On the reserve?
So the people that don't live on the reserve have a bit of an idea.
Well, you can come into towns. You go to do your groceries. Try being stared at all the time. Try being judged that your mind is different because of your color of your skin is different. You know, people think that you're treated better, so you're treated differently by the rest of society, and you're not treated. You know, it's just different. Some people feel attention. They'll start a conversation with you, and they'll be like, "Oh, no offense, but I want to know how you've seen it, but, like, you know, we are kind of the same, you know. We live in this current day and age with the rest of society, you know. We can't be that different, you know, but people look at us like we're sometimes we're freaks, or sometimes we're heroes, you know. So it's different. You got different sets of ways of treatment, you know, and I think it really depends on what town you're in and that town's history and the type of people that live there, you know. Like, in a town like Caledonia, it's predominantly European people, right? And there you'll have a lot of people that have only ever been around European people, so there's no other people of color to talk to, so to them it's no problem being racist, you know. So, and going into towns like that, that's where I myself have found the problems, you know. That's where you get stared at the most. That's where people treat you differently. You know, the cops, some of my friends have been beat up by cops for walking through town, you know. They've been accused of being car thieves or just, you name it, criminal or whatever, you know, radical. It's insane sometimes. What you'd think we were still in the 1800s, you know, KKK and all that. It really doesn't seem that much different. It's just behind curtains.
I think one thing that's pretty common for any group of marginalized people in Canada is that we're seen as an oddity. You know, gays and lesbians, Muslims, and Indigenous people worldwide are seen as oddities. So there's this sort of detachment, like you're looking at us through a lens, or through, like, you see us through your image of an Indian before you see us as a human being.
Right.
And that is something that is almost impossible to live with day to day. For my brother and I, we grew up on the reserve, but like I said, we come from a multi-ethnic family. So for us to go off of the reserve, we don't necessarily look indigenous. Our skin is more fair. We don't fit that typical Indian image. So for us to be stigmatized and then, but at the same time, people don't believe that we're indigenous because we don't look the part. He doesn't look like Tonto and I don't look like Pocahontas. That's probably the hardest part to deal with. And also, I mean, we've been privy to conversations which we probably shouldn't have heard because we don't look like that. And I think that's made us feel that even more.
I'm glad you brought that up, and the fact that you're like the fly on the wall listening to what people are saying about your own natives, your own customs, your own people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's like we can fit into both realms because we do look native, but we also do look like we have Irish in us, mm-hmm. you know, so it's... You know, sometimes people won't really know that we're native, and they'll say, like in my own shoes, where people have said things, and it's like, what? You know, I'm half native. You know, don't say those things. You know, I get angry. But
what are some of the most prominent things that people keep misunderstanding from your point of view?
They think that we have money coming in every month somehow. I mean, Marie Traynor, the mayor of Caledonia, standing up on, I think it was CH News, and their wonderful coverage of the whole reclamation, and that we have some kind of a reward of race, I'll call it, because we're indigenous. They think that the government gives us things only because we are, quote, Indians. That's not truth. That's not a reality for us. In fact, our ancestors created treaties so that our education would be taken care of. So in reality, we do get money from the government to go to school. But that was in exchange for making agreements with the government that we would reside in common territory. That was also in an agreement that was to be upheld for our children's children, so that would continue on, so we would have the same opportunities as other Canadian children. But yeah. What they don't understand is that it's not like we get money to go to school and they pay for everything. I'm in university right now. I have failed so many classes in my post-secondary education. And for every class that I fail, I have to pay back every dollar and every cent for everything. So if I am unsuccessful, I'm in debt automatically.
I work a $6 an hour job in a pizza shop on the reserve to live. You know, I do not get any cash monthly, yearly. You know, I might get my income like the rest of Canada, but to all those who think so, I do not get money. Mm-hmm. I work a $6 an hour job, man.
And on top of that, I mean, we've got little housing in our community. My brother and I both live with our parents. I am a single mom. That's the position that we are in because we are in this community. We feel for our community. We relate to our community. We grew up in this community. If we leave, we're alienated.
Right.
We are sort of living as aliens in another town,
right,
if we go.
It's another lifestyle.
So it's sort of like we're set up to stay in this environment.
Does it seem like you're foreigners in your own land?
I don't feel that personally, you know, but in a sense, I guess you could say that, really, yeah, because sometimes you go in the cities, you know, and people look at you different, I think, you know, and treat you different. Like, I don't know, just being treated shitty or like you don't have a say, you know. Like, I almost got beat up by cops for walking in a neighborhood in Toronto at night. In that situation, I felt like an alien on our own land.
This comment that I constantly hear being played repeatedly in the mainstream press, let's call it, talking about you don't pay taxes, you get a check. You know, there's two things that are wrong there. One is the misunderstanding of how the finances really work, which we hope to clear up today. But let's take a couple of minutes and talk about what's wrong with the mainstream media coverage and why you think it's wrong.
Well, I think first of all, especially in the sense of paying taxes, you need to look at that our community had its own government, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Council. It's made up of a group of hereditary chiefs that we lived by. And in 1924, the federal government imposed an elected band council, system on our community. This was something that was enforced at gunpoint. they were held at gunpoint, and there was RCMP officers enforcing this political system on our community from that day until I think it was a few years later they took away the guns in the RCMP. So we don't pay taxes, but I don't think that the majority of Canada understands that Canada's citizens are in a social contract with their government, and they pay taxes, and they surrender their voice, and they abide by the rules that the government declares, and in exchange, they're guaranteed protection by the state. That's the social contract theory. I think it was Rousseau that talked about that. For us, we have a different political system. We don't pay taxes, but we have responsibilities to our community. We have to follow through with things to our community. We are held accountable to our families just as much as anyone else is. Our leaders are held accountable to us. They have to listen to us, but we just don't have the money trail. We come from different worlds, and when it comes to not paying taxes and paying taxes, I think the only difference that you can really articulate that both parties will understand is that we're not and don't consider ourselves Canadian citizens. The only reason why we're treated the same is because the elected band council system was imposed upon us in 1924.
Can you explain why the band council was opposed upon? From your point of view, what you think it served, what purpose it served?
Well, in essence, Canada was dealing with a foreign government up until that point. And I couldn't tell you the significance of 1924 specifically, because the assimilation policy, obviously it was the slow policy that from the time of the Indian Act in 1876, and even going back further than that, there was the Gradual Civilization Act in 1857. That was a part of the policy of getting rid of the Indian, getting rid of the indigenous people. There's a lot of history. Yeah.
Yeah, you take away our language, you take away our government, you take away all that, you don't have the original people, you think you can make us forget about it, you put in a new government, take out ours. It was like a span of a century, this assimilation process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they put that government in there, that was basically saying, here, we'll give you this, it's a little handout, and through this, the government will come into your reserve, right? Because the band council is the federal government, basically. They put that in place so that, like, kind of controls everything.
It's kind of going on in Iraq right now.
And
George
it's going,
Bush is putting in his band council over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same thing, you know, and that's what I think what they were trying to do in 1924. They were trying to assimilate us. They took away our way of life, you know, our government, our principles, you know, our hearts, you know, everything.
It's been a long, slow conquest,
like,
is what it is.
Yep.
And that's another thing that I'm glad you brought that up, is that it's so rooted in history. It's so important for us to remember our history, and I think for the majority of the Canadian population, history doesn't play that important of a role in their identity. Whereas for us, our identity is linked in our history. I was talking to one of my professors yesterday, and she was saying how, you know, our relationship with not only the Canadian federal government, but with the crown, with the British crown, is like a marriage. And when a marriage fails, you can't really define what one thing made it fail. It was a combination. It's a process that made it fail. And I mean, at this point, we're not ready to end that marriage. We're not ready to end that relationship with the federal government, with the crown. We want justice. We want truth. We want trust, and we want accountability. And that's why we're behind the barricades.
When you say things like the crown and talk about the queen, white people get confused by that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what they forget again is that our relationship with European people, I'll call them, started with the crown. One of the first treaties was the Royal Proclamation.
1763,
thank you. 1763. Yeah. 1763. Yeah. It is where it all started, and that was with the King of France. And from there, when the Britain and France were fighting their own war, France lost, Britain won, so they got everything. And all of the land ownership over here went over to the British Crown. Around when Canada was becoming a country, the British Crown surrendered all of their Canadian title to its own federal government. So that included things like the Gradual Civilization Act and the Indian Enfranchisement Act and any kind of royal proclamation, any treaties, any wampums, anything and everything got transferred to another government, an independent government from the crown.
The thing that people keep forgetting here is that there are three nations in this country we call Canada. They started from three nations, being French and English and, of course, the First Nation.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize, too, is, like, the reason it's taking so time is that this issue could deface a lot of things that the supposed government supposedly stand for, and that the provincial and federal governments keep passing it back and forth to each other. And the reason we speak of the crown is because Canada wasn't even a country till recently. It was the Dominion of Canada, you know, and it was run by England before that. Even before that, what was it?
Northwest Trading Company.
Yeah,
Hudson's Bay. It's all based on commerce.
You know, right. A lot of people don't realize that. They don't. Like Nanta said, they don't know their history, so they don't even know. It's like, for me, it would be like taking a total outsider and putting him into a group of people to make decisions for them or tell them what's what when he doesn't even know that group's history or anything, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, history's written by those with power, those with money.
They write, and they control it. They write it the way they want, so they can structure these thieving governments.
It's the original corporation, folks.
Yep, absolutely. And that's another reason why I think the people with Henco are so... I mean, it's funny to me how the federal government was so fast to pump money back at Henco, money that they've spent on policing, on surveillance, on, you know, hotels for the OPP, which, by the way, they had to bring in to manage the Caledonia protesters, not the Indigenous protesters. That's important to remember. You know, all this money that they're investing into this occupation, and you hear Canadian citizens complaining about their tax dollars being spent on this, when they could have easily turned the money around and said, you know what, we're willing to sit down with you and discuss this, we're willing to settle this. But no, we are interrupting the corporate flow. We're interrupting their dollars.
That's it, exactly. It's a money game. And, you know, it wouldn't have cost the taxpayers any of this money they're complaining about. There wouldn't be this complaint about a loss of business had the federal government stepped up to the plate in the first place, which you're right in saying it's a hidden agenda. You know, there's so much that's been hidden for so long that they don't want to bring it up because they'll have to admit that they have basically lied and stolen lands from the Indigenous people since the beginning of time on this
right.
country, on this continent.
Well, that's it, right? That's why I was saying, like, the federal government and the provincial government, they keep passing off. And the only thing I can say to that is, like, to the Conservative Party, you know, you're only going to cost this country more. More and more people are only going to turn against you, the more money you're going to cost people by not dealing with this. This isn't something you can ignore. You know, you got a whole town of people that say they're losing their town. You know, you got a whole reserve of us, you know, saying we're losing our sovereignty.
I think you're losing your culture. It's more,
you know,
than property.
You know,
here. They don't get the fact that you are losing your very way of life.
Mm-hmm.
The language, when you take somebody's language away and their culture away and expect them to act like the country that they were born and raised on. I mean, that to me, that always just rubs me the wrong way. But, you know, Canada is made up of immigrants. And a lot of those people in that town, Caledonia, where did they come from?
Right, they came from England, they came from France, they came from Ireland, all over, right? And it's just like, that. How long can the government ignore it for? They can't just ignore this, you know? It's gone too far.
Let's turn this around, you know? Yeah. If it was them, if they were the ones living on the reserve, they got a land tract deal because they helped other foreign countries take over their territory and et cetera. We have the growth of settlers, of immigrants. If they can just imagine what it would be like to help a foreign country take your culture away, they might have an idea of why the native people still fight.
Right, that's all it is, flipping it around, you know. Look at it in our point of view, you know.
They can't. Let's talk about the mainstream media. Take a story. Take one story and tell me what the event was and what really happened from your perspective, and then talk about what you read in the mainstream news or heard on TV.
Well, let's look at the most recent story that we've seen on local media. I don't know if I can name them or not.
Name it all.
Okay, so we've been watching the coverage of CH News here in Hamilton, and first of all, I mean, it hurts to watch it. It is physically painful, emotionally strenuous.
Racist.
Absolutely racist. We can't call it any other name. A duck is a duck, you know what I mean? We were watching some coverage of the event and of the occupation, and there was one day when some men from the city of Caledonia, or rather the town of Caledonia, came up to one of the barricades. This is a barricade that wasn't made by the men of the occupation. This is a barricade that was started by the OPP, so that's an important fact to remember. The men came up to the barricade and they started to disassemble it. Now, I'm not sure what they were trying to do. This is the men from Caledonia. I'm not sure what they were trying to do in taking down this barricade, but they were doing it. So our men saw that they were doing that, and they went over to the barricade to find out what was going on. One of the men from Caledonia had a video camera, and he caught on tape what happened. Now, CH News took the footage from this video and clipped it so that it was it showed one of our men throwing I think it was a 2x4 over across the other side of the barricade. First of all, the men from Caledonia's faces were blurred. They were completely disguised. Our men exposed.
And
nothing.
They threw the first 2x4.
Yeah.
They threw it. We were throwing it back, and they only showed us throwing the 2x4 at the Caledonia people, and they show our faces, but not theirs. So they just want to show the radical Indians being angry, throwing stuff at the Caledonia people, when really the Caledonia people had came there tearing down a barricade that we hadn't even put up, that the OPP had put up, and they want to make it look like, you know, they're the heroic, you know, vigilantes of the town, and we're the bad Indians, you know. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that CH News did. They turn it around. They make us look like radicals that are war hungry. We've been trying to keep this occupation peaceful for months on end. The only thing the media wants is the eye candy. They want to show people the burning tires. They want to show people with the bandanas on the face carrying the sticks. That's why we're not doing it anymore. Because we don't got anything to hide, you know, with bandanas over our face. I'm there proudly. I will show my, you know, but that's just what the media wants. They want the general public to see that and take that as, okay, that's what the Indians are there. That's what the Haudenosaunee or the Mohawks or Onondagas or Cayugas or whoever, that's what they're like, and that's how they deal with it. Mm-hmm. But really, they don't see the whole political structure that's behind that, right?
I'm so glad you brought that up. Because we have a very bad problem in this location with one-sided media. I want you to correct as many stories while you're here now on Independent and Campus Radio. All those clips, all those news reports, let's hear your side of the story so we can get a balanced medium. That those people, they may not be Caledonians, but people that are going up probably from Hamilton and other outside areas, and they're angry and they think, well, it's the Indians that are doing this and the Indians that are doing that. They get their information from our local mainstream media here, and it doesn't seem to show both sides fairly. So please, let's clarify some of these stories. Pick any one of them, pick a number of them, and let's hear your side of some of those situations that we've been seeing on our nightly news channel.
Here's a good story. The day after the when the cops came, someone came up and asked us if anything interesting had happened. Like he had seen everything that had went down, and the guy wanted the way he had put it was if anything interesting had happened. To me, cops coming in and beating the crap out of women and children and people for protecting their rights and sovereignty is not interesting.
No, it's a travesty.
He's only interested in seeing what the public wants to see. And that kind of disgusted me. And I said to him, interesting? Do you find that interesting? And he's like, oh, well, you know what I mean. It's like, no, I don't know what you mean. So there you have it. They're only out, as an example, they're only out for the bad stuff.
Well, they have an agenda.
Right. Yeah. They don't want to see, you know, us spiritually kindling. You know, they don't want to see us be the good side of it. They don't want to see the politics and the spirituality that we have. All they want to see is bandanas and fighting.
And that's the sad reality with any social justice action or any human rights action in the media, is that sensationalism comes first. And when it comes to human rights and their violations, which is what this is, it's a violation of our human rights. They only report on these things after the fact, and usually it's too late. Like, what if CH News had been behind, or not, it wasn't even a barricade at that point. What if CH News had been at the occupation site talking to us, you know, getting to know why we're there before the OPP raided? I wasn't there when they did that. I don't know if anybody else was there when they did that. I'm
sure. As I went up a few times myself, and I saw the 900 CHML van and somebody there from Global Channel 11 trucks. Yeah. In fact, I was really pleased to see the original coverage when the takedown first happened. When it first happened, I was watching local news. Channel 11 had a camera up there live, and she showed the native people coming back to the campsite and quietly and respectfully walking the OPP back out to the road. And I was on the phone with a CBC TV reporter at the time, and she was telling me what she thought was happening, or what should have happened, or what usually happens when a situation like this goes on. And I was watching the television set and listening to her and saying, no, 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 the natives have taken back the campsite. And she kept saying, don't you mean the police moved the natives off and they're being arrested? No, I'm watching it live right now, and I can't believe I'm watching it on Channel 11 News. And this is a peaceful retaking of their own campsite. And there's no violence happening here. I can't believe it. I just see them walking very slowly, very proud, very respectfully carrying flags.
Mm-hmm. And she was flabbergasted. So she hastened her trip down the road. Now, I trust CBC News because they don't have the same agenda. Mm-hmm. I was also very surprised to see Channel 11 doing that kind of coverage, but I never saw it again.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. Channel 11 is where we saw in my living room is what I saw of the morning of the raid. Like I said, I'm a mom, so I couldn't go down there because my daughter was there. I had to take her to school that morning. And I wasn't going to go down there in any kind of conflicted or any kind of, because I am a mom, I need to be there for my little girl. So, but my father and my friend went, and, you know, it was terrifying to watch that happening on the news and to watch it live and to watch it from CH, but that is the only positive coverage. And it was, you can't thwart live, you know, you can't edit live, you just have to let it go. And that's, I think, where our power and where our opportunity is. But the tricky thing about live is that you need to have articulated what you want to say into like five main points. And for this issue, because there's so much history to it, it's next to impossible.
Yeah, it's very tough, especially when you're in the moment and mm-hmm. you know, you see five police officers on one woman on the ground. That's a little extreme.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Another negative thing that happened in regards to that story with the men throwing the 2x4s at the Caledonia people was that the stories that followed that and the response to that video, that footage that was sent to CH was disgusting. There was an interview with one of the spokespeople at the barricades, at the occupation, Janie Jameson, and she said that what do you expect about our men retaliating? They're there to protect women and children. There are women and children behind the barricades. So then the CH reporter clipped back to this video footage and said, obviously you can see there are no women and children behind the barricades, and it showed, obviously, that there was no women and children on the bypass bridge. I mean, what do they think that we are? Do they think that we are irresponsible parents and that we would have our women and children right behind men who are throwing beams at us? It's ridiculous. It's taking words out of context and twisting them so that they can present an image to the Canadian public that they want them to see.
After we let them in that barricade to cover the story, how dare they? Mm-hmm. You know, like... How who would even give these type of people a job? You know, in my mind now, CH News are nothing but a bunch of weasels. You know, we try to give them this story, and these, you know, like you said earlier, we're interrupting the corporate ladder, you know, and sure enough, these corporate guys come in here who are funded by the corporate ladder, and I think that's really their goal, is to sabotage the whole thing instead of help it. Because I'm very offended, you know. I have no faith. I will never believe what CH News has to say or interpret a story in any way ever again after
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
I'm disgusted.
They have lost credibility with the First Nations community all across the board. It doesn't matter if it's CH Vancouver or CH Hamilton. CH's credibility has gone down.
What
and
were they
it
trying to prove
to
by doing that? By saying there's no women and children behind the barricades?
Right.
What were they trying to prove to the public?
And then
that
they
we're liars? Why don't they just call us a bunch of liars then?
And then they showed another clip of Janie after that, saying that she had a very different story the next day, trying to play it up that she was contradicting herself, so she was played out to look like a liar. Then the next story that followed that was... there was a parish and a bunch of churches in Caledonia, I guess, that got together to put on a supper for the OPP. And the way that it was reported was that there was the poor OPP officers were getting fed this free meal by the city of Caledonia. And they had all the grade 2 students in the town. I keep calling it a city, but it's not really a city. It's a town.
It'll be a city very soon.
Yeah, if we don't stop the development. But they had all the grade 2 students color them these placemats, which is, it's a nice gesture for grade 2 students, I guess. But, I mean, the psychological implications of having your children... using your children's innocence in a story like that, exactly, to create an image of these poor OPP, when I myself know for a fact that the OPP are, when they were brought in, first of all, they were brought in excessive numbers to protect the protesters from a Caledonia peace rally, which was getting out of hand, and they're staying at hotels. I went to a hotel in Brantford, and they had taken up all the rooms in Brantford and Simcoe. So, I mean, they're not poor. They're not starving. But this parish got this story out to CH. And then the next story, which followed that, was, you know, there was an officer who sadly was killed in Windsor. And the OPP were at his funeral mourning. And this was the story that CH put after our occupation. I mean, to take somebody's death and to thwart it and sensationalize it, to fuel the fight of hatred, I can't even believe the spiritual implications that will have, you know? That's somebody who's lost. That's a family in mourning. That's, you can't bastardize life anymore.
I'm embarrassed to say, you know, when I was on the phone with the CBC reporters working their way to the site the morning of the police raid, I was embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
I was embarrassed that it was even happening in the first place, and even more embarrassed that the coverage that followed and the stories that followed were what you're describing, and I want you to try and describe as many of those situations as you can now. And we'll try and get it out to the independent media, who have no agenda other than to get the truth out, to fight for social issues, because we are just overrun by the corporate agenda. Nobody is worth anything unless it pays a corporation, makes it worthwhile for a corporation to sell profits and sell stocks. That's how our society's become.
Mm-hmm. Just on that, I'd like to say one thing, is that this almost shows how this bat, if you listen to Nanta's story there, how they butchered the footage they got of Janie and her story. It shows how this battle is being fought right now. The wealthy and the government and the corporation, their weapon for this war is the media. They're using
mainstream media.
The mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And our weapon for this is our past, our sovereignty, our truth, our culture, you know, our hearts. That's our weapon, knowing the truth. And the only thing the government can do is try and take that truth, film it, and then bend it, and then
exactly.
feed it, spoon feed it to the rest of the Canada. So that's what's sustaining them, is mm-hmm. this bent lies by the government.
Right. Let's talk about Henco for a little while, because, I mean, they're definitely not innocent, not an innocent party in this at all. Henco Industries has been sending out these media updates that we've also got copies of that we've been able to look at. And one thing I think that's been really, really thwarted in mainstream media is the way that the public thinks that we are treating that property and that site. Now, I think that people outside of this maybe think that we are just looting the houses that are there, taking them down, or living in them, or I'm not even sure. What's your perspective on what is going on at that site and the houses?
I went up there the day of the takedown, and, you know, I saw moms that were still living in those new developments, those houses in that development, sunbathing on the front yard, peaceful, blissful, little baby kids playing on the road in front of these big, they were OPP vans with smoked windows, and who knows what was inside of those vans. And I was, you know, I was caught with the juxtaposition of, there's no fear here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people live here. They're not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the fear coming from?
Right.
So what is there to destroy? There's just a frame. You know, it's just frame houses. You know, the natives that I talk to are very honest, and they're very simple, and they're very forthright. And that's what comes with honesty. You don't have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what seems to be wrong is ignorance.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the key right there. They're dependent on ignorance. If they don't have ignorance, if people look into the history and look into what is actually the truth, and their entire world is exposed.
Well, let's talk about handcuffs. Well, you know, it doesn't take too much reading to come up with the Haldeman track.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came across a great book that anybody can borrow from the Old Purg Library, and that's in McMaster University on the second floor of the Student Center. It's called Native Peoples in Canada, Contemporary Conflicts by James Friedrichs, or I'm going to spell his name, Friedrichs. I think the first two pages, he explained everything. So there are some people that know the true history. And the thing that I find ironic is the first thing they say is that the Native people have been lied about for decades, for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of non-Native people there. A lot of non-Native people from Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, steel workers. There's been people from Palestine, China, mm-hmm. what was it, Sweden or something?
Yep.
All those countries, you know, coming out. And that just shows, man, like, this ain't just a skin-colored battle, man. This is a full-out revolution, you know. It's been happening since Rome, you know, dates past the Bible, and here we are in the year 2000 fighting the same thing. Like you said, you know, it ain't a matter of your skin color, it's a matter of what you're aware of, and who's doing it to you, and why they're doing it to you, and what they get out of it. That's the picture to be focused on.
And I think a lot of those people have come out, too, because they recognize that Henco is, you know, representative of that, the corporation and the Indigenous people. I mean, a lot of people who are socially conscious and who know history and who know, you know, about globalization and the process of globalization recognize that it's the people versus the corporation. And it always has been, and it will forever be until there is an absolute revolution of the way that the world works. I mean,
that's exactly what's happening.
This
here.
This is our input.
Exactly.
To the revolution.
Exactly.
You know, we're not just going to sit back anymore. You mm-hmm. know, we got something to say. We're not going to swallow our pride anymore. We're not going to be back and squished into a corner anymore,
right.
Because that hasn't got us anywhere for the last 200 years. Things just get worse, you know. To anyone out there, man, stand up.
I think I'd like to say something. This has nothing to do with what they were just speaking about, but it has to do with what what you were saying is, what is it like to be Native, and like how could anyone else understand? I think one way, like, to maybe to help Canadians understand what it's like to be Native is to imagine if someday — this may sound far-fetched, but this is the only way I could probably explain it — is imagine if, like, say, someday aliens came in from outer space and took over Earth, and they made it so that they'd take your children and send them to special alien school, and they would beat them any time that they spoke English and said, "Nope, you have to speak this language, and we will beat you." And they'd do experiments on you, like pull your teeth and other painful, like, abuse, you know, and they raised your children. And eventually those children grow up and they have children, and eventually your children, your grandkids, forget things like Christmas, and they forget all of the human earth things that we do here and that we love, you know. They forget their ways, and they speak a different language, and they're not allowed to do things on their own land that they have done for thousands of years before. So the only way — that's just like one little glimpse into what it's like to be Native, I suppose — is just imagine if someday aliens do come here and, like, take over, you know, humans, and we're treated like animals. Imagine that. Okay, my name is Jeeks. I've been rapping for, like, the last 6 years. I've been producing my own music, and the song I got is called "Times Are Changing." It's just kind of a song that reflects on the reserve and the situation we're in. And I hope you enjoy it.
Reservation must have ears. My peers never see nothing. At the same time, hear all the gossip. I'm wise to these moms playing possum. Believe nothing you're told, only half of what you're shown. I should have known fool's gold is worthless. I redefine the purpose of a man living on land that was stolen by the government, by making my tribe survival public. Take my hand, I'm reaching from the abyss. You'll make a difference if you listen to this. Most reserves are made for wildlife, armies, and Indians, and that's why we live our hard lives with a grin. Maybe that's why my people harm our next of kin. Maybe that's why we're vexed, cause we've died within. Then again, there's pride in keeping the truth alive. I see sides of the resin, only one can win. Why don't they care anymore? Times are changing. Whoa. Live in a place where a man of my race wouldn't think twice or hesitate to put a lead pipe to my face. Where the feds feed a tread when confrontations arise. The reservations got tears in my eyes. I've seen families with 5 children survive and cope with very little. Making sandwiches with nothing but hope in the middle. This shit'll change your lifestyle. But meanwhile, life goes on in an age of denial. A strong smile if the hood ain't a shoney child. Don't forget when we remember the past, we're a threat. I believe that broken promises can break a dream. White lies told by white men can make a regime. North America, land of the free, no question, was built by slavery and oppression. Nevertheless, I see society as something that I'll quietly infiltrate by piling all this money I make. And why don't they care anymore? Changing.
I have some information here that I just wanted to share with everybody. I've been working on information to release to the press, and we're working on trying to get something together where we can invite the social justice groups, Journalists for Human Rights, minority groups, anyone who's interested, independent media, and people who want to know the truth about this occupation, about First Nations issues, about the vision and the reality outside of mass media. If you have any questions or if you want to contact me, you can reach me at meetmeinthegarden@hotmail.com. Feel free to email me at any time and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. This is a paper about rights and entitlement, trust and accountability. And it says, the state promises to protect its citizens at a price. Around the 18th century, nation-states were determining how to hold control of their citizens. This is called a social contract. In essence, citizens pay a tax, surrender their voices, and abide by the rules the government declares. In exchange, those people are guaranteed state protection, namely protection of personal property. This system does two things. It allows the state to control its citizens, and it creates a sense of entitlement. The social contract says you are entitled to state protection because you are a citizen of the state. The social contract is dependent on trust and accountability. You have to trust the government will tell you the truth, and if they do not, you have to hold them responsible. Why don't they care anymore? If the state is not acting on their end of the bargain to protect you and your personal property, keep you safe or hear your concerns, or tell you the truth, you feel like you are not getting what you are entitled to. This is a breach of the social contract. In my eyes, I've seen families with five children survive and cope with very little, making sandwiches with nothing but hoping. Canadians are not told the truth about First Nations. Therefore, the federal government has not held up its end of the bargain with its citizens. When Canadians seek out the truth, they are presented with fraudulent documents by their government. When there is a question raised about First Nations lands, it sounds unfounded or made up because you never heard about it before. The federal government depends on public forgetting the history. They depend on anger blinding our vision. And they depend on all people being confused by bureaucracy and getting so frustrated that we all end up divided. Ignorance in the minds of Canadians about First Nations issues feeds the injustice. Staying ignorant and saying nothing in return says you're okay with the injustice. When children are taught about bullies in school, they are told that the first thing they need to do is to take their stick away. Our minds are coming together as one. We are in the right. We have never surrendered. We have never ceded the territory or our sovereignty. A bully has done us wrong. If we let go of the illusion that they possess the power to return our lands and instead empower our fight with the knowledge that these lands are our responsibility, we can disarm them. If we expose the lies, we take their stick away. When we disarm the federal government by spreading the truth and enlightening the people of Canada, we make huge steps for all Ungwehome brothers and sisters. The truth will set us free. We are fighting for more than recognition of our territory. We are fighting for truth and accountability. To all those people who live along the tract, please, please understand that this is not an issue of not appreciating your homes, not respecting where you live. There are no eviction notices. There is no intention to evict anyone. That was never an issue. That was a rumor that was going up and down the tract. We want respect. We want to live in harmony with you. That's all we want.
Know the history of the land you stand on.
Thank you for everyone who's actually listening. It really, you have no idea how much it means and how important it is that you're just using your ears right now.
And that was Nanda, probably mispronouncing her name. She came in with her brother and a friend, a couple of young men. That was really good information. I'm glad she came. I wanted to read to you a little bit that I pulled out of this book that I've been promoting here, Native Peoples in Canada, Contemporary Conflicts. It's just a great overall read. And he talks a little bit about the history so that we can try and understand what's going on there. And they mention the 1763 Royal Proclamation, Canadian lands or Indian lands. And after that, around 1812, because of the 1812 surge of settlers in the population, just like we have a surge in 300,000 more people going to come to Hamilton and why we have urban sprawl up there right now in the Six Nations, and that's what the Douglas Estates are all about. I guess it was back then in 1812 as well. They had a surge of settlers from, an increase of 80,000 newcomers. They had this Indian Act trying to accommodate these people. They had a dozen provisions, and out of these were prime examples of mismanagement in the seven treaties. And one of them, there was two main ones, and the main first one we're talking about is the Haldimand Grant, and the other one was called the Gunshot Treaty, and I can't really get into why it was called the Gunshot Treaty, but they were the most bungled transactions in the history of Indian treaties. Negotiations probably started as early as 1783-1784. It was about 139 years later, in October, November of 1923, that they finally were finished, and they were mentioning the RCMP coming in and taking over the reservations and imposing a band council in 1924 at Gunshot. So as a result of a direction dated in September of 1783 from Governor General Haldimand, Sir John Johnson ordered Captain Crawford of the Indian Department to start making the necessary land purchases in the Bay of Quinte area from the Indian people so that they could put settlers there. And then Brant got into this, and there are indications that Captain Crawford exceeded his instructions and negotiated for many parcels of land. The matter was brought to Sir John's attention early in 1791. And in the following intimation to the deputy surveyor or general, he said, "I never received any deed from Crawford from the purchases he made, the deed I had drawn up at the head of the bay. He's never seen these pieces of paper that Crawford was busy selling off." He also says the indications are that the surveyor never did complete the blank spaces, and the agreement was considered invalid. In 1784, Captain Brant and his followers were offered by the Governor General Haldimand land in the Bay of Quinte area as a reward, but Brant decided there was too many European settlers there, so Brant decided he would come here to Six Nations area that we know of today, and he allegedly purchased from Crawford, and there was no deed ever produced, the district outside of the area covered in the 1923 settlement. And in October 25th of 1784, and this is important, October 1784, Haldimand reserved for the Mohawks and others of the Six Nations about 1 million prime land acres in southern Ontario, all a land for 6 miles on either side of the Grand River from the mouth on Lake Erie to the source was deeded to the Six Nations. And nevertheless, in 1784, Captain Brant and most of his followers moved to the banks of the Grand River. And I know that's kind of a quick history, but there's where the Six Nations started from, and here we are today, hundreds of years later, and we're still arguing over the land.